Colossians 4:2-4:4. The 15th talk in a series on Colossians was presented by Ron Julian on October 24, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
You can tell it's the time for our fall conference. I have my jacket out of mothballs. I thought I'd wear it one more time before it goes back in. Okay. We're coming to the end of our study in Colossians. By my calculations, this is the 15th time you have had to listen to me talk about this. I think probably next week will be the last. We're in chapter 4, verse 2. We really have kind of come to that. We're just trailing off to the end of the letter. And I think we have come to that spot where, in essence, he's sort of wrapping up with a few words of exhortation. I don't know that it is tightly tied to what it is he said in the last section, tightly tied to the section, you remember, we just got done talking about the wives and husbands and children and parents and so on. I think he's just sort of bringing things to a close. I want to talk about a couple of verses here. I don't know that we're going to get very far. Starting in 4:2, devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with an attitude of thanksgiving, praying at the same time for us as well, that God may open to us a door for the word, so that we may speak forth the mystery of Christ, for which I have also been imprisoned, in order that I may make it clear in the way I ought to speak. I think we're going to limit ourselves to talking about that this morning. Some of you have heard me talk about prayer a fair amount. It's one of those issues that troubled me from really close to the beginning of my becoming a Christian. And so one of the things I have done in my study in the Bible is to try to go to those places in the Bible that talk about prayer and come to some sort of a better understanding, at least, of what's involved. What is it that's happening there? In order to understand what I think is happening in his exhortation here to devote yourselves to prayer, I need to back up a little bit and sort of give you my spiel on prayer and what sort of a thing I think it is. The problem is we come on this verse and it's just sort of, he kind of jumps in and out, and this verse, as we see it translated here, what it's saying could support a lot of different pictures. I mean, you could come to this verse with a number of different theologies of what prayer was all about and just go away reinforced in them here, saying, yeah, I know what he means. He means do this because of this, but the this's would be different for the people who are coming to it. So I want to try to fill in for you what I think he's getting at. What is it that he wants of them? What would he want of us? This is probably important for me to do as well, because I know that we as a group, and maybe even not you so much as the guys that end up standing up here, have a reputation as not being big on prayer around here. I have heard people say, oh yeah, you're that group that doesn't believe in prayer. So since I know that people are thinking out that out there, I do like to try to take the opportunity to clarify the sense in which I at least do and do not believe in prayer. I think prayer is a big deal in the Bible, and we ought to make it a big deal, but it's a particular kind of big deal, and it's very easy to miss the point. This is one of those commandments that you can't keep by just doing it, if you know what I mean. That is, you don't fulfill Paul's desire here by saying, okay, I'm going to make sure that I pray every day. You could do that and very easily miss the point of what Paul's talking about. So that's what I want to try to get across to you. And of course, for some of you, this is old territory because I've talked about these things many times. But going through Colossians, this is where we are. So that's what we're going to talk about. Now, my spiel on prayer. Actually, I'm going to give you a subset, a part of my spiel on prayer. There's a lot of talk in the Bible about persevering in prayer, continuing in prayer. Pray without ceasing, we're told. There's that kind of language. And in looking at those passages, I think I have come to understand what sort of thing that's being talked about. It does not mean, I would say, make sure that you pray as often as possible. Make sure that every day, every hour, every minute, you are talking to God. I don't think that's the sense that comes from those passages. For instance, let me take you to a couple of passages. I'm going to try to do it quickly, but to illustrate for you what I think is at stake in that kind of language. The one that is the clearest in my mind is in the Gospel of Luke in chapter 18. And I'll try not to belabor this too much, but let me remind you what it is we're looking at here. Now, he was telling them a parable to show that at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart, saying, "There was in a certain city a judge who did not fear God and did not respect man. And there was a widow in that city, and she kept coming to him, saying, 'Give me legal protection from my opponent.' And for a while he was unwilling, but afterward he said to himself, 'Even though I do not fear God nor respect man, yet because this widow bothers me, I will give her legal protection, lest by continually coming she wear me out.' And the Lord said, 'Hear what the unrighteous judge said. Now shall not God bring about justice for his elect, who cry to him day and night? And will he delay long over them? I tell you that he will bring about justice for them speedily. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth?'" Okay. You may have questions that I can answer to clear up what I think about this passage at the end, but let me try to give you a brief overview here. One of the keys to understanding what's happening is what Luke tells us at the beginning. He was telling them a parable to show that at all times they ought to pray and not to lose heart. They ought to pray at all times, he says. But I think we can see that what's at issue in this story is not, am I praying every minute of the day, but am I continuing to pray, or have I given up? Have I lost heart? The widow in this story is facing the question, am I going to keep going back to a judge who is so obviously corrupt, so obviously uninterested in justice? What am I going to do? The heart of the story, as I understand it, revolves around the choice that the widow faced. Am I going to keep going back or not? For her, even though she was dealing with a judge who was corrupt, who did not fear God, did not fear man, this is a guy who didn't really, there's no pressure you could put on him because he didn't care about what was right. Nonetheless, she kept going back. And eventually, for his own reasons, to get her off his back, he acquiesced and gave her the justice that she was asking for. Now, this parable, I think, is oftentimes misunderstood as saying that if I really want something from God, what I need to do is keep going back and bugging him, and if I bug him long enough, I'll get it. I think that is not the point at all. God is not like this judge in a lot of ways. That's part of the point of the story, is that God is not like the unjust judge. But one of the ways he is not like him is he is unbuggable. I mean, if we stop and think about it, it's just not possible to wear God out. It's not possible to go back so many times that he says, "Oh, I'm really tired of this. I think I'll give him what he wants." He doesn't get tired. Now, if your goal is to convince God to give you what you want, the news that God doesn't get tired is not good news, because now what leverage do I have on him, right? But see, that's in the story. The point, as I understand it, revolves around the difference between God and the judge that the widow is dealing with. If it made sense for her to keep going back, even though she was getting the answer no, how much more sense does it make for God's people to keep going back, knowing that He is not unjust? He does care about what is right. He does care about His people. Jesus calls them His elect, His chosen ones here. Is He going to turn away from the cries of His chosen ones? No, He's not. So that's all the more reason why it makes sense for us to pray at all times and not lose heart. Now, why would we lose heart? The fact is, one of the parallels that does hold true here, although God is not like this judge in His character, our relationship with God is like the widow's relationship with this judge in one very important respect. We, as the people of God, keep going back to Him for justice, to make things right. And in many ways, the answer continues to be no. At least, the answer is not yet. But when the answer is not yet, then that means that we continually face the same question that the widow did. Am I going to go back or not? The people of God have been calling out to Him for 2,000 years, and yet things pretty much go on the way they always have. There's no guarantee at all that, I mean, think of the situations in your own life, the injustices, the evil, the suffering that is out there. There is no guarantee at all that when you cry out to God, God, make it right, that today, tomorrow, or the next day, that things are going to be right. When is it going to be right? When has God promised to take care of everything that needs to be taken care of? Well, I think this is why Jesus says at the end, however, when the Son of Man comes, will He find faith on the earth? Yes, He says, God will answer them speedily. But what is God's answer? To the cries of His people throughout the centuries, what is God's answer? How is He going to meet their cry? He's going to meet it when the Son of Man comes back to bring justice on the earth. That's ultimately when He's going to answer their cry. Now, you understand, I'm not saying that God has no answer for us today, that there's no point in talking to Him about anything that's going on in my life right now. I don't mean that. But ultimately, God's answer to our cries is the return of Christ to bring about His kingdom. That's the answer that we need. In that sense, then, in this life, having been a believer for some, 26 years, I've lost track. Where am I now? Long time. I still face the question, am I going to go back? This has been a long time. And while there have been tremendous blessings from being a believer in that time, my life has also been very difficult in a lot of ways. I mean, I'm not trying, there's the violin playing and everything. I'm not asking you to feel sorry for me. I mean, I think my life is just like yours, right? I mean, it's had some good stuff and it's hard. I mean, it continues to be hard. I think that's true for all of us here. Why do I keep going back? Why do I keep turning to God when He's so willing to let me go through so much that is so difficult? Why would Bob go back? Look at all of the things that have been happening in his life recently that Jack was talking about. Shouldn't he just say, what's the point in going back to God? Well, no, he shouldn't. The fact is that he shouldn't. Because he has reason and we have reason to know that God is good, that God keeps His promises, that things are on track, that God is going to do what He promised to do. He is always the one to go to. Okay, so the admonition to pray at all times in this parable is not make sure that every day at a certain time you pray for a certain amount of time. The admonition is don't despair. Don't lose heart don't give up. That's the challenge that we face, is are we going to despair or not? And what Jesus is saying is don't despair. Keep going back. Think about who you're dealing with. You have every reason to keep turning to him. That's what I understand him to be saying in that parable. There's another place where we run into language like this. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, and I know I've talked about this with this group before as well, but just let me remind you real quickly. At the end of 1 Thessalonians, a similar ending to what we have in Colossians. I mean, we're coming to the end of the letter, have a series of exhortations that Paul is making. And in chapter 5, verse 16, rejoice always, pray without ceasing, in everything give thanks, for this is God's will for you in Christ Jesus. Now, this is a part of an admonition. I think it's all part and parcel with what he's telling them here. Like just before, see to it that no one repays another with evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for one another and for all men. Paul's speaking into a situation like our own. Things are hard. It's hard to deal with each other. I face the question of how am I going to respond? Am I going to return evil for evil to those around me? It's tough. In the midst of a life that is difficult and I'm faced with many challenges, how am I going to respond? The picture that Paul has, I mean, he paints it very clearly throughout his letters over and over again, is, look, if you step back and look at what's really going on, you can see that the current difficulties are the part of a much bigger story. And the bigger story is a good story. The bigger story is a story that has a great ending to it. You're going to love the way this turns out. This is a story about a journey, and this is a journey worth making. It's a tough journey. I in my own mind, find a great deal of perspective and significance and comfort, really, from picturing the Christian life as a journey. It's like the journey of the Israelites through the promised land. If I think of myself as being at home, then the question sort of arises, what kind of a home is this? I mean, is this the best I can do? And if I'm trying to sink in and dig in my roots here, then I'm going to be constantly moving from place to place, trying to find that place where I can dig in and get something worth having. And it's never quite going to be enough. But if you think of yourself as being on a journey, then, okay, I put up my tent along the way, but sooner or later I'm going to have to get out of that tent and move on, because I didn't come here to live in a tent. I came here because I'm on my way to the promised land. That's the picture of the Christian life, I think, that Paul has. So, when I'm on the journey, and it's my feet are sore, and it's hot, and I'm trudging along, and it's really boring, what sort of an attitude do I have? Well, it depends on what I'm doing it for. Like I've said, you know, 20 million times. It makes a lot of difference. You're out there on that journey. Do I picture myself as being lost in the wilderness, desperately trying to find a place to dig in? Or am I going someplace? If I'm going someplace, if this has a purpose and a meaning, I'm doing this for a reason. I want very much to arrive where I am journeying, then it doesn't make the current circumstances pleasant, but it gives them meaning, and it gives me courage, perspective, gratitude. I'm not grateful for the difficulty of the journey. I'm grateful for the fact that there is a destination, and I want to get there. That destination is what my life is about. I would be lost if that city on the horizon were not there. But it is there, and that's where I'm headed. So I'm grateful. With all of that in mind, then, when Paul says, rejoice always, the always is, the emphasis is, in all circumstances. not because difficulties and suffering are enjoyable, but because those are part of a journey that is worth making. My joy is in the destination. My joy is in the fact I am not alone. I am being guided to the very place that I most need to go. I couldn't get there on my own, but I'm going to make it. I mean, all of that, all of the understanding of what the grace of God means to me, what it means to be forgiven for my sins and to have a hope and all of that, that's the stuff that I would rejoice in spite of what's going on around me. And the third thing he says, in everything give thanks. The idea is not, God, thanks for the nice house I have and thanks for my kid, but no thanks for that guy who's given me grief over here, and no thanks for this difficulty here, and no thanks for the fact that my health isn't so good. Give thanks in everything. Not because everything is good, but because everything is a part of a journey that is taking me toward what is good. My gratitude is not for suffering. My gratitude is for the fact that my suffering has a purpose, and that purpose is good. So, in this list, in between, rejoice always and in everything give thanks, is pray without ceasing. Which is, again, that same sort of idea. It's not, you need to make sure that you're always talking to God. Oh, today I haven't talked to God, I better make sure that I talk to God today. It's just like what Jesus said. Pray at all times without losing heart. Don't just rejoice or pray or give thanks when you feel like everything's cool and okay, well, yeah, I'll take this from God, so I'll be thankful for this, I'll rejoice in this, I will turn to Him and say these things or seek life from Him because I think He's demonstrated right now that He's worth talking to. But when things get tough, He had better demonstrate to me that He's worth talking to or I'm not going. No. Rejoice in everything. Give thanks in everything. Pray always, without ceasing. Don't stop. Don't give up. Don't let the pressures push you away and send you someplace else. Keep going back. So again, these passages are not about you need to make sure that you are faithful in keeping the ritual of prayer. These passages are about, are you going to keep going back to God or not? Do you see Him as good? Do you see Him as the source of life? And thus, in the midst of your life, He is the one that you turn to. You are grateful to Him. You trust Him, and so you are entrusting your welfare to Him. Is that what you're going to do, or are you going to give up? That's what I understand the admonition in these kind of passages to be. It's not so much about the discipline of prayer, the ritual of prayer. It is about the heart of prayer. Am I the sort of person who goes to God because I think He's there and I trust Him? Okay. Now, you may recall that we're talking about Colossians. Chapter 4, verse 2. Devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with thanksgiving. All right. Let's talk about this word translated devote. I think that is not the best translation of the word. It actually means something more like continue or persevere. In fact, the noun form of this word basically means perseverance. Devote yourself to something sort of has that picture of, you know, I'm going to join some team at college, the soccer team or the basketball team or something, and the coach has given me a pep talk and says, are you going to be devoted to this or not? And so the question is, he sees me, you know, Friday night and I'm going to the movies. Oh, you mean you're not down at the court practicing? Are you devoted to this or not? Meaning, are you going to do this above everything else, or are you just messing around with this? Calling us to be devoted to prayer sounds like what he's saying is, I don't want you to do anything else. I want you to just pray. You think that maybe you want to go watch your kids play soccer? How can you do that? You need to be devoting yourself to prayer. You're going to invite people over to dinner? How can you do that? You ought to be on your knees. You ought to be devoted. Don't be distracted by anything else, but pray all the time. I don't think that's what he means. The idea is more like persevere in prayer. Continue in prayer. And there's a couple of things that he might mean by that. And I'm not exactly sure. They're very close to each other. He might mean just what we saw Jesus meant and Paul meant in another place. The idea being persevere in praying. Don't give up. Don't turn away from God. Don't give up on going back to Him, but continue in it. Keep on going back. And at this point, I'm sort of inclined to think about it that way. The other way of thinking about it would be more like, I want you to persevere in your faith. I want you to persevere. Hang on. Continue. Hang in there. And how are you going to do that? What are you going to be doing while you're persevering? I want you to persevere with prayer. And in the end, it sort of comes back to the same thing. Are you going to continue in your faith and thus keep on praying or not? But the idea is that idea of continuance. Is it going to keep on going? Not devoted as in, instead of spending 1 hour of your day, you need to spend 10 hours of your day, but rather persevering, continuing in the sense of you need to keep coming back as opposed to giving up. That's what I understand him to be saying. So now you can see why I went to the trouble of telling you those stories about the other passages, because I think in essence it's something like that that he's saying in this passage as well. We can see that that is a very biblical idea about prayer. The word here, I don't think when you look at its use, devoted is not really a very good translation. That's not really what it meant. So I would argue that the admonition here is like what Jesus was admonishing us to do in the parable of the unjust judge. Don't give up on God. See Him as the source of life and goodness and keep going back. I think that's reinforced by the next thing he says, keeping alert in it. It means like keeping awake. Now, we could take this in a sort of a silly, trivial sort of thing. If anybody has ever done having the quiet time where you get up early in the morning or something like that, we could see him as saying, when you're praying, stay awake. You know, don't drift off to sleep, which is easy to do. But it's very, very unlikely that he means that. When you see this word being used in the New Testament, keep alert, keep awake, the idea is almost always something like this. Most of the people living in this world are asleep. It's like Jesus makes this kind of analogy. He talks about he's coming like a thief in the night. And if the homeowner had known when the thief is coming, he would have been awake and prepared. But you don't know when I'm coming, so you had better be awake all the time. The idea being that I don't let the stuff around me, the stuff in the world, put me to sleep. It's so easy. I mean, you and I come here, and what's going on in our lives, right? I mean, we have this stuff. We're sitting in these chairs. The temperature in here is probably not what it ought to be. It never is. That's my life, right? This is the stuff of my life. But if this is it, if this is the whole package, then all right, then I had better do what I can to make it work here, you know, make this work the best I can. But people who think that this is all that there is have fallen asleep. They don't realize that the thief is coming. They're not going to be prepared when he comes. But Paul says, believers, you're not asleep. You're prepared. You know that something is coming. I don't know when Jesus is coming back. That's not the point. He doesn't mean keep awake so that when you see, you know, Bill Clinton standing in the temple in Jerusalem, then you know, okay, here we go. That's not what he means. I mean, it's plausible, but no, I did not say that. I did not say that. The idea is that in my own life, I stay awake. I'm prepared. I know what it is that the outcome of all this is going to be. I know that there is a judgment coming. I know that my eternal destiny is going to be decided by my judge. I know that he has offered me mercy through Christ. I know that life is about something different than what I have been making it. I know those things. I'm not asleep. So, keeping alert in prayer is, instead of drifting off, instead of forgetting about God, instead of forgetting that God is the one with whom I have to deal, I'm awake. I know that my life is not just this stuff around me, and so I keep going back to God because I know that that's where the real story is. Sure, if you're giving me trouble, I'm going to try to work it out with you, but 10 million times more important than whatever trouble I may be having with you is the trouble that I could have with God if I don't come to terms with him. Knowing that keeps me awake. I had better deal with him. He's the one that, in the end, has to be happy with me. He's the only one. So, okay, well, one more thing then. He says, keeping alert in it with thanksgiving. It's very common for Paul to connect gratitude with prayer. We saw in Colossians earlier, you may not remember because we've been doing this for a while, but earlier in Colossians we saw him talking about one of the things that he wanted. If you remember back to the prayer at the beginning of this letter, he was praying that they would be filled with spiritual wisdom and understanding. And what was one of the results of that? That they would be grateful. And then he spells out what it is that they have to be grateful for. That Jesus died on the cross to justify them before God and to give them an inheritance and a hope. That's what they have to be grateful for. And what he wants is for their understanding to grow so that they would know that that's true and have the appropriate gratitude for it. But remember in that prayer, it started with understanding. I'm coming to see what a great thing God is doing for me, and gratitude becomes the result. We have a tendency to, well, you understand, I'm not knocking this necessarily, but we see him saying, devote yourselves to prayer, keeping alert in it with thanksgiving, and we turn that into, okay, the formula for prayer is you have to make sure that you give thanks each time. Well, that's fine. I mean, people who pray in accordance with, they think, you know, it's the acts, adoration, confession, thanksgiving, supplication, and you have to do it in that order. And it's not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm not against it. But there's not anything necessarily right with it either. Because it's not the fact that I have a formula that tells me I do each of these things that turns it into the right sort of prayer. What Paul's concerned with is that I be grateful. Not that I make sure that I say thanks every time I talk to God, but that I have gratitude. In other words, it starts back with my understanding. Do I know that I have something to be grateful for? So, in essence, what I'm saying here is that his admonition is not an admonition to partake of a ritual in a certain way. His admonition is for me to come to terms with the reality of the gospel. Remember that it is true, and so keep going back to God and be grateful in doing it. Keep going back to him, and the context is, I mean, in our lives, keep going back to him in spite of the reasons you have not to. Don't give up. Keep awake. Be grateful in spite of whatever it is that may be coming towards you, because if you understand what's really going on, you know that there's something to be awake about. And there's something to be grateful for, because something truly amazing and significant is going on. Now, this is not a trivial thing, then. His devote yourself to prayer is not just make sure you pray a lot. If I'm right in the kind of thing that he's advising here, not advising, admonishing us to do, then he's speaking to the very heart of what it means to be a believer, the very struggle of the faith. Am I going to keep going back? Am I going to see God as good and the source of my life, even though there are so many pressures on me not to? The thing is that I don't think we see in the Bible any sort of assurance that if I regularly participate in the ritual of prayer, that that somehow is going to assure or make it more certain that I am going to be faithful when the pressure comes. That's not what he's getting at. What he's saying is, when the pressure's on, keep going back. That's the choice you face. And remember, he's talking to folks who are prepared to walk away from the gospel. These are the folks who've been listening to the heretics in Colossae who have been telling them, well, now there's this other thing is what you're supposed to do. He's urging them to hold fast, to remember who God is and to keep going back to him. This is a big deal in that sense. But it's not, that's what I meant at the beginning. You can't obey this just by obeying it. I mean, you can't do what Paul's asking to do by just saying, I'll make sure that I pray every day. Because that may be the expression of a dynamic faith, or it may not. But it's not the ritual that makes the dynamic. It's that decision in me that this means something to me and I will hold fast to it. That's what gives the meaning to it. Now, I want to talk about one more thing, and then I'll open it up for questions. He says, praying at the same time for us as well. And he means for himself, the apostles, the ministry of the gospel. That God may open up to us a door for the word, so that we may speak forth the mystery of Christ, and so on here. Now, there are two things I want to say. There's a little clarification I want to make. I don't know about you, but that last sentence, verse 4, in the New American Standard, in order that I may make it clear in the way I ought to speak, that's not very clear to me what it is that means. What is he saying? I think when you go and look at the Greek, that it's clearer what it is that's happening there. It's more like, I would sort of paraphrase it, in order that I may make the gospel publicly known, in order that I might make it manifest, just as I am obligated to do. Something like that. That's what I hear him saying. What he's saying then is, pray, here I am in prison. So my freedom of action is somewhat limited at the moment. Pray that a door would be opened to me so that I can take the gospel out there, the mystery of Christ, this mystery which God has revealed through Christ to the apostles. He has given me the task of going out and telling this story, so pray that the door would open so I can go out and tell this story, making it known, which is what I am obligated to do. That's my task in life, is to make this story known. So I'm asking you to pray that I can go out and make this story known. That's what he's saying. Now, that's my little clarification. The big issue that goes along with this, and again, it comes back to our picture of prayer, and I think you can start to see why, given the perspective that I have on prayer, why I might have the erroneous reputation out there of being against prayer or not big on prayer, because I think prayer is essential, but not necessarily in the way the Christian culture always advocates it. I don't think that the ritual is so essential. We can do it or not in various times in various ways. You know, in this group, sometimes when we get together we pray, and sometimes, even on Sunday morning, we don't, which is an amazing sort of thing for a church group to do. And if somebody comes in and says, you know, those guys went through a whole church service and they didn't pray, you might get the idea these are guys who are down on prayer. Well, no. I mean, our interaction with God, my dealing personally with my Creator, is an essential part of my life. But there is kind of a reaction. I have a reaction somewhat to the way that prayer is seen by people out there. Now, I'm going to say something here, and I want you to understand the compassion, I hope, the tenderness in my heart that I have in this situation. I am not looking down on anyone, but I want you to understand the struggle I have when I look at this stuff. I know someone right now who has a relative who is going through some very difficult health situations. I'm pointing over. It's not Jack. This is another thing. But we're being forwarded email from the people more directly involved in this situation. And this email is all about, it's very essential that I can get as many of you as possible to pray for this situation. And here specifically is what you need to pray for. It's very important that you pray that in this operation that this doesn't happen. And you need to pray that this thing here goes this way. I mean, very detailed instructions with a very urgent sense that it is important that as many of you pray specifically for this thing as you can. Well, obviously, my heart goes out. I mean, you know, we have had the situation where our child was going through major surgery in a scary situation. I mean, I don't look down on anything that someone might do or say in their desire to do well for their kid. That's not what I'm talking about here. But the fact is that back behind that is a certain theology that has kind of floated around in the church that prayer is this tool that God has given us to make things happen the way we want them to happen. What has been the great quest of mankind from the beginning? What does every pagan want to be able to do? I want to be able to control nature. I want to be able to make it do what I want to do. I want my life to go well. I want the rains to come, but not too many rains, not too much. I want the crops to grow. I don't want the bugs to come and eat them up. I don't want to get sick. And I have no control over these things. There's nothing I can do. And so I try to find that way that I can control things to make sure that it comes out the way I want. Well, as good as our intentions are at times, I think that we have let creep into the church in our attitude towards prayer this idea that somehow praying in the name of Jesus, getting as many people specifically to pray and pray for specific things, is the way to make things happen. Where the pagans went wrong is they thought that shaking a tambourine and dancing around the fire was going to make it happened the way you wanted. We understand that it's in praying in the name of Jesus with as many numbers as you can get that makes it happen the way you want. That's a more godly Christian way of doing it. But in essence, it comes down to the same thing. Do I have control or not? And there is a picture out there of prayer that sees the essence of prayer as being my ability to control my circumstances. Well, there's a lot that we could talk about, but I would argue that that's not at the heart of it. But what do we make, then, of what Paul is doing here? Why does he tell them to pray that he might have this door open for him to proclaim the gospel? If Paul doesn't believe that prayer is this tool that I can use to change my circumstances, then why do it? Well, that's a big question, but let me just give I'll try to make a simple answer here, and then we can talk about it. There is a difference, I would say, between the idea that, of course, in the difficulties of my life, I reach out to God asking Him to do what I would like Him to do. That is not an ungodly or faithless thing to do. That is not a pagan or superstitious thing to do. Jesus, knowing that He was going to the cross, I think very clear, you can see he talked about it all along the way. He knew he was going to die on the cross, and yet when he came to it, he asked the Father to take it away. Was this faithless? Was this pagan? Was this, you know, shaking a tambourine and trying to make things happen the way you want them? No, not at all. And in fact, he made it clear, I want what you want, not my will, but yours be done. Even though his attitude was not my will but yours be done, did he say, so I won't bother to pray? No. He was in agony. He didn't want to go to the cross. And so, very naturally, he called out to God, please, if there's a way, take this away from me. But there wasn't a way, and God didn't take it away from him. And I think he knew that from the beginning, but his heart compelled him to ask. Well, if in that situation where he had to know, this is not going to come out this way, this is not the way this is going to go down, how much more am I going to call out to God in the difficulties of my life when I don't know what ultimately what God has in mind for me? It may be, as often happens, that in this circumstance I cry out to God, and this is one of those times when God is using my circumstances to show his faithfulness. I cry out for help, and the help comes. It may be one of those times. It may be one of those times, and there are a lot of these as well, when I call out and the answer is, I'm sorry, I've got something else in mind, and you're just going to have to go through this. Both of those are responses of God. But it is not faithless of me to ask. But it starts to become faithless and superstitious of me if I think of prayer as my tool to make God do what I want, and to think that somehow if I can get more people praying, that's going to make it more likely. In this circumstance, can we imagine that Paul is thinking, God, who made me an apostle, gave me the task of going out and proclaiming the gospel throughout the world, is going to leave me to rot in jail if I cannot find enough people to ask him to get me out? It's not possible. In fact, we know it's not true because Paul expresses in other places his confidence that God is taking care of him and is going to rescue him in this situation. I mean, he's not counting on everybody else to make it happen. But in 2 Corinthians, we see this picture that Paul paints of all of those praying for me, all of those who express their desire. They look at my situation and they say, God, Paul is a great gift to us. Help him proclaim the gospel. We care about his circumstances. All of those who pray in that way have the opportunity to be grateful, he says, when God takes care of me. When God answers, when God delivers me and sustains me, then not just I have an opportunity to be grateful, but everybody does. But if all of those people had not prayed, you know, Paul says, all in Asia have deserted me. Was he lost and alone without support because everybody had deserted him? There wasn't anybody left to ask God to do anything for him? No. He could count on God whether he was alone or together. But it's not meaningless that the people of God would see Paul's circumstances being in jail and look at that and say, I don't like this. I wish Paul could get out and proclaim the gospel. I wish he could come here again and talk to us. And so I'm going to pray. I'm going to ask God to do that. So Paul saying, pray for us as well, is not, oh, you guys, I really need to recruit a lot of people to pray so this will happen. Paul, I'm convinced, is absolutely confident that God is doing right by him. He is in jail by the will of God, and he will come out by the will of God. But he nevertheless is saying in the spiritual life of the people that he's talking to, don't be indifferent to my situation. I mean, if I'm saying to you to pray, to turn to God concerning those things that are most significant in life, don't forget about me, the apostle of the gospel who is in jail. Pray about that. Seek from God that he would open the door. Care about the gospel. Not just so much about me, but about the gospel. Care about my opportunity to proclaim it. So, I mean, it's fairly simple when it comes down to it. I'm not praying because I know that I'm moving the hand of God. I pray the way any person does, very simply, this is on what's on my heart. You're the one to go to. I'm asking you to do this thing. I don't know how God's going to respond, but he's not indifferent to what I'm saying. So, putting all of the package together then, I think the sort of admonition that Paul is making here is not so much one of, let's make sure that we have a discipline of prayer, let's make sure that we get a list with everybody's name on it so that I don't skip somebody and they end up without God's blessing because I didn't get them on the list. That's not at all the attitude. The question is, what sort of person are you? Do you think God is there Do you think he is the one to go to? When you look at the needs of your life, do you think you're going to find them met by us here, or are you going to find them met by God? And if he's the one, then go to him. I think that in essence is what he's getting at. Okay, so we've got a little time for some questions or comments. I ask you to wait for Roger to bring the mic so we can hear you, and people who listen to the tape later can hear you as well.
I'm wondering what you think the place of forms or rituals might be in the Christian life. So, for example, Pascal talked about, well, if you're wondering if Christianity is true and if it's the way you ought to live, you ought to try. Just start out by trying to live as a Christian.
Uh-huh.
And where I think of these students here, they've submitted themselves to a form. And you could say in the pure sense, you ought to be studying because you have a love for learning. But the truth is, unless somebody said, read John Hobbes's Leviathan, probably none of these students would pick it up and do it. However, in submitting themselves to that form, they might find a love for learning and find things in Thomas Hobbes that are really worth knowing about. So in regards to prayer, if we take away the idea of, well, I ought to pray, if we try to, in the kind of the ritualistic part of it, or the oughtness in it, do we run the danger of maybe not praying because we're waiting for the purest motives before we pray, if you understand? Or
right.
You could say that, apply that to any of the Christian disciplines, whether it's giving or fasting or any of those things.
Right. That's very clear. And that's exactly right. I don't think that's true. So that makes a very clear distinction as the kind of thing I'm trying to say. Certainly, if that's the sort of thing that prayer was, we could take it to a real extreme. If prayer were like taking a bath, where very, very clear immediate consequences result, I could say, well, you ought to be the sort of person who cares about cleanliness, but there are definite consequences if you wait around for that inspiration, I'm going to be a cleanly person today, and I haven't felt like it for a month. There have been real consequences here. My heart may not have been in it, but I would have been clean if I had been taking a bath all that time. The question is whether that's what sort of a thing the disciplines are, whether prayer is a thing like that. And what I'm saying is, when I look at the Bible and see the way it is talked about, the sort of thing that is discussed there, I don't see it as being that. I don't think that's what it's being presented as. I have to admit, couple that somewhat with my experience in that in my own life, I have pursued this discipline, and I know many people who have pursued this discipline, and I'm not convinced that it has done what people have claimed that it does, that in fact, pursuing that discipline is equivalent to reading Hobbes. Even if I hadn't been inspired on my own because I've been required to, I have gained the thing that it gives. I think prayer is the sort of thing that it has no gain to give me unless it is an expression of what is actually going on in my heart anyway. I can discipline myself to do it for years and years, but it's not doing anything to me. It's not intended to do something to me. The picture of what does things to me in the Bible is like the trials that force me to confront various issues and that kind of thing. That's the picture that I have. Now, let me back off of that a little bit in saying that there is a place for, especially together as a community, there is a place for educational expressions, things that are intended to remind us the truths that we believe and what we're about. When I'm up here talking and I'm saying, you know, here's the truth, here's what the gospel is preaching, it may be that for some of you, I'm hitting you at a spot where your own mind at the moment is very far from the kinds of things I'm talking about. In fact, in the circumstances of my life, it may be a struggle for me to get where I'm talking about. I mean, that it may not be that if I were to just go on inspiration that at the moment I would say these things. It may be that my mind is right now struggling with this issue or that issue, and yet there is obviously value in bringing my attention to this and talking about it and giving us an opportunity to think about these things. So in that sense, yes, I don't have this model that I go through life ignoring the claims that anything might make on me for how I ought to do things right now and just spontaneously doing whatever I most feel like at the moment. I'm not saying that. But, and so therefore, the idea of a corporate prayer, the idea that I might pray or we might pray together, and I recognize that some of you are not into it right now, and maybe even right now, it's not that I'm going through the motions, that I don't really believe it, but at this particular moment, I would not be doing this if it weren't for the structure that has created it. Sure, there can be value in reminding ourselves together what we're about and giving ourselves the opportunity to pray or not. Maybe this is the time for you. Maybe it isn't. I don't have anything against those things. What I'm saying, though, is that I think our understanding of the admonitions to pray, I would say that the rationale behind them, the appeal, is the kind of appeal I was making. I don't think Paul is saying you need to make sure to do this because if you don't, then you're not going to get the benefits that come to you from doing it. I don't think that's what he's saying. I think what he's saying is, in the midst of this situation where you're trying to decide whether you're going to continue to follow the gospel or not, I'm saying to you, continue to follow the gospel. Make the choice to go this way. Which is a choice that cannot be made by saying, well, I'll try what he's saying and make sure I do some praying. If I'm continuing to pray every day in response to what Paul says, but meanwhile I continue to listen to the Colossian heretics and I keep wandering farther and farther from the gospel, that's not really getting me anywhere. What he's saying, I believe, is here is another place where you confront the question of whether this stuff is true or not. Are you going to keep going back to God? Are you going to continue to persevere in prayer? Or are you going to stop? So, I guess there are two claims that I'm making. My more modest claim is that this passage is not telling me that I derive benefit from the ritual. This passage is calling me to faith. My broader claim would be that the Bible as a whole does not argue that there is intrinsic benefit in the ritual, but with the qualification that I made, that that doesn't mean then that there is no point in being involved in having a corporate expression or a ritual expression. I mean, an actual decision. I'm going to take the time here together to pray, or I'm going to take the time alone right now to pray. It's not that that isn't a good thing to do, but in and of itself, what I'm saying, I don't see the Bible saying you need to make sure that you regularly stop and take the time to do this. It is instead advocating, I think, you need to be the sort of person who sees God as the one to go to rather than not. And then that's going to come out in a lot of different ways. So the bigger claim, we would have to look at a lot of different things to ask whether that's really true or not. Maybe I'll settle for the smaller claim at this point, that what Paul is getting at in these admonitions, I think, is one kind of thing and not the other. What else? Well, okay, let's stop.